We've been reading through Luke's Gospel on Sunday mornings, and we're in chapter 23. In the last few weeks, we've read how the Lord Jesus, God's Son, was arrested, tortured, interrogated by the Jewish religious leaders. Why do they hate him so much? You've answered that question. They hate him because they like to think of themselves as good people. They've got a reputation for being religious, moral people. And the Lord Jesus has told them that they are sinners, just like everyone else. That they need to be saved, just like everyone else. He's told them that he's willing to save them. He's willing to forgive their sins. He's willing to change their hearts. But they're furious. They hate him for talking like that. How dare he call them sinners? And that's why they're so determined to get rid of him. That's why they have him arrested. That's why they torture him. That's why they put him through this brutal interrogation. And then they take him to the Roman governor, to Pontius Pilate. Why do they do that? Well, because they want Jesus dead. But they don't have the legal authority to execute anyone. But they do believe that they can persuade Pilate, the governor, to do it. Of course, they've got to find some reason why Pilate should execute Jesus. Pilate's not going to be interested in some quarrel about religion. He's a politician. He's a lawyer. They've got to persuade Pilate that Jesus has done something that the Romans think of as a crime. Well, we saw in chapter 23, verse 2, that these Jewish rulers brought three accusations against Jesus. They say, "We found this man, one, misleading our nation. Number two, forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar. Number three, saying that he himself is Christ, a king." These are political accusations. What they're saying is that Jesus is a revolutionary, that he's trying to overthrow the authority of the Roman Empire, that he's setting himself up as a king to challenge the emperor, Caesar. Now, those accusations are false. And the Jewish leaders know that they're false. Jesus had never said or done anything politically subversive. Jesus had told people that they should pay taxes to Caesar, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. And when Pilate questions Jesus, he realizes very quickly that these accusations are false. Yes, Jesus does claim to be setting up God's kingdom on earth. But it's not a political kingdom. He's not setting up an alternative state. He's not calling on people to take up arms and rebel against Rome. The only thing Jesus has called people to do is to turn from their sins and to trust him to save them from their sins. He's never promised people wealth and power in this world. He's never told them that they'll be free from Rome if they follow him. He's promised them everlasting life in the world to come. It's simply not true that Jesus is a rebel against Rome or a political agitator. The Jewish leaders know it's not true. Pilate knows it's not true. And he says so. He says so in verse 4. I find no guilt in this man. But Pilate is in a tricky position. We've talked about it in the last couple of weeks. Why? Well, because he's a politician. And the thing he's most interested in, like almost every politician, is his own position, his own career. And if he plays this wrongly, it could damage or end his career. He's got a difficult balancing act to perform here. On the one side, he feels he can't afford to upset these Jewish leaders. In the past, he's done things that they've not liked, and there have been riots as a result, and they've sent complaints to the Roman emperor, and he's been severely reprimanded. If they were to send another complaint about him to Rome, that could well mean that his career's finished. So even though he knows that Jesus is innocent of any crime, Pilate may well feel that it's in his interest to execute Jesus anyway. But then on the other side, Pilate is well aware that Jesus is very popular with many people in Jerusalem, with the crowds, with the common people. Thousands of people turn out to listen to him whenever he speaks. So Pilate is worried that if he does execute Jesus, those people might well start protesting. He could trigger riots himself. He could even start a revolution himself by accident. And again, that would mean the end of his all-important career. What you've got here is a man without any principles. If he had been a principled man, a just man, a God-fearing man, then once he had said those words, I find no guilt in Jesus, that would have ended the matter. He would have set Jesus free and faced the consequences, whatever they might be. That's what it means to have principles, isn't it? Not that you do what's right when there are no consequences, but that you do what's right when there are going to be consequences, whatever those consequences might be. Pilate doesn't have any principles. He's simply looking for a way out of a difficult situation. And given that he's the sort of man he is, the Jewish leaders know that if they put on enough pressure, whatever he said, Pilate may still cave in and give them what they're demanding. And so that's what they do. Verse 5, we read, but they were urgent. Pilate's already said that Jesus is innocent, but they won't leave it at that. They were urgent, saying, but he stirs up the people. He's been teaching throughout all Judea, from Galilee, even to this place. Well, we saw last week, when they said that, Pilate breathed a sigh of relief. Because it seemed as if they had given him a backdoor out of his situation. Why? Because they had just said that Jesus came from Galilee. And Pilate didn't have legal jurisdiction over Galilee. Galilee was in the territory ruled over by Herod Antipas. If Jesus had come from Galilee, and if Jesus had committed most of these so-called offences in Galilee, then Pilate could just hand Jesus over to Herod and say, he's your pigeon. You try him. So Herod tries that ploy. He does send Jesus to Herod. But to his dismay, Herod refuses to deal with it as a legal matter at all. Herod doesn't hold a trial. He just tries to get Jesus to entertain him with a few miracles. And when Jesus fails to do that, Herod just mocks him and tries to humiliate him and turns it into a charade. And then he sends him back to Pilate. So Pilate is still left with the prisoner in his hands. And he's still left with his big dilemma. But at least Pilate had bought himself a little time to think and to plan the next move. And in verse 13, you can see what it was. Pilate then called together the chief priests and the rulers and the people. Pilate summons the chief priests and the rulers again. But not just them this time round. He makes sure that the people, the ordinary people, the crowds who had been so enthusiastic about Jesus, he makes sure that they're called to the palace too. I don't know how he summons them. Maybe his agents just work the city, spreading the news. Jesus has been arrested. He's at the palace now. Let's go, let's see what's happening. Or maybe he actually sends out official criers who shout the news in the marketplaces, summoning people to the palace. Maybe he just makes sure that the right people, the influential people, especially in the nationalist community, are tipped off so that they can get their supporters to the palace quickly. But one way or another, Pilate makes sure that it's not just the chief priests and the rulers who are there for the next stage. He makes sure that the people are there too. The ordinary people, the people who have gone wild over Jesus in the past. What's Pilate playing at? Well, he believes that these crowds are going to support Jesus. That they're going to demand that Jesus should be released. And then Pilate will reluctantly have to give in to them, won't he? He'll be able to say to the priests and the rulers, well, you can see I've no option. We don't want a riot on our hands, do we? And Pilate will have to set Jesus free in order to keep the masses happy. And if the Jewish leaders do then complain to the emperor, well then Pilate will be able to say, I had no option. I mean, if you had seen those thousands of people gathered round the palace protesting, you'd have seen, I had no option. That's the card that Pilate is playing. Get the crowds involved. And he's got another card in his hand as well. It's this. It was the recognised custom. It had been carried on for many years, approved officially or unofficially by Rome, that at Passover time, the governor should set one prisoner free as a goodwill gesture towards the people. What Pilate's planning to do is this. Usually the governor would leave it to the people to decide who they wanted to have released. Well, Pilate is sure that if he can get crowds of people, the masses, there at the palace, and if then he brings out Jesus to them and then says, who do you want me to release this year? Then they'll all, of course, shout Jesus. After all, he's there. They'll all shout, release Jesus. Pilate can even go further than that if he has to. He can nominate Jesus as the one to be released. And, of course, the crowds will shout for him. And then Pilate will be able to say to the priest, see, I've got no option. It's an established custom to give the crowds anyone they want, and I can't go back on it now. And he's got the perfect answer to give to the emperor if he's ever questioned. Well, when I set Jesus free, I was only following the precedent set by all the governors before me. Approved by yourself, remember? Yes, there were suggestions that Jesus had been involved in subversive activity, but it was a rule that I should set free anyone the crowds asked for, and they just happened to ask for Jesus. That's his strategy. Get the crowds there, then get them to demand that Jesus be set free, and Pilate's off the hook. That's what Pilate's trying to achieve. In verses 13 to 16. It's a very graphic picture, isn't it? Great artists have painted the scene. You can see Pilate and he's standing on the balcony of his palace, and he's got Jesus at his side, and the priests and the rulers are standing around him with angry faces, and there's a sea of faces below them, the common people who have crowded into the courtyard. And Jesus is wearing the splendid clothes that Herod dressed him up in to mock him. But Jesus' face is a mass of bruises and cuts where the soldiers had beaten him up. And the crowds are shouting and they're calling out. And some of them maybe are waving their fists at Pilate. And then Pilate calls them to order. And the crowd falls silent. And then Pilate turns to the chief priest and all his cronies. He's speaking to them, but he wants everyone in the crowd to hear. And he says, "You brought me this man as one who was misleading the people. And after examining him before you, behold, I did not find this man guilty of any of your charges against him. Neither did Herod, for he sent him back to us. Look, nothing deserving death has been done by him. I will therefore punish and release him." And at that point, Pilate expects the crowd to erupt into applause. "Yes, yes, yes! Set him free! Set him free!" And if the Jewish leaders start to protest, then Pilate will just say, "Look, I've got a duty. I've got to set free whatever prisoner they demand. You can hear them." And Pilate will be off the hook. But Pilate has underestimated his opponents. Yeah, he's a skillful politician, but they're more skillful than he is. You see, they've got their men in that crowd as well. The moment they realise what game Pilate was playing, the moment that the crowd started gathering at the palace, these Jewish leaders had their agents working the crowd, getting ready for that moment when Pilate would make his great offer to set Jesus free. See, Pilate was playing conjurer's choice with the crowd, wasn't he? He'll tell the crowd, "You're entitled to have one prisoner released." But meanwhile, he'll only offer them one candidate. And of course, he's sure that the crowds will jump at that. The Jewish leaders are determined that when that moment comes, there'll be a second name on the ballot paper. And their agents in the crowd will be urging people to vote for that other candidate. And the leaders think they've got the perfect candidate. A man called Barabbas. We're told about him in verse 19. He'd been thrown into prison for an insurrection started in the city, a genuine attempt to start a revolt, and for murder. This man was exactly what the priests had accused Jesus of being, a subversive, a revolutionary against Rome. A man who had already struck a blow against Rome. He was a killer. He was a terrorist in the nationalist cause. These priests, they really know what they're doing. Yeah, Jesus was popular with the crowds. But why? Precisely because they didn't understand what he was about. Most of them did think he was planning to start a revolution, that he was going to set himself up as an earthly king. And now they hear Pilate say, "Well, I've examined him, and I'm satisfied that he's not guilty of any subversive or revolutionary behaviour. And Herod agrees with me." Well, when Pilate said that, he was trying to defend Jesus. But from the point of view of lots of people in the crowd, he was telling them that Jesus was never going to give them what they wanted. that Jesus would never raise a standard against Rome. And meanwhile, the priest's agents are going through the crowd, and they're whispering, and they said, "You heard what Pilate said? This Jesus, he isn't interested in Israel. He's no revolutionary against Rome. He's never going to set up the kingdom. We don't want him. He'll never set us free from Rome. What we want is someone like Barabbas. He's a real freedom fighter. He's not afraid to stand up for us. He doesn't just talk about a kingdom. He'll fight for one. He's a doer." So Pilate makes his great announcement. "I'm going to give Jesus a token punishment and release him." And he thinks he's giving the crowd exactly what they want. He's expecting a roar of approval. But what does he hear? Oh yeah, he hears a roar. But what are the crowd roaring? "Away with this man! Give us Barabbas!" And Pilate can't believe it. He tries to reason with them. But they're chanting now, and it's a steady, relentless chant that drowns everything. "Crucify him! Crucify him!" "Why?" shouts Pilate. "What's he done? I'm ready to release him." But their shouting just gets louder and louder and louder. Pilate realizes that he's painted himself into a corner. He thought that the priests and the people were pulling in opposite directions. And he was prepared to back the people against the priests. But now the priests and the people have joined forces. And they're all screaming for Jesus to be crucified. And Pilate decides that their demand should be granted. It doesn't matter whether Jesus is innocent or guilty. That's never been Pilate's big concern. All he's ever wanted was to keep the situation under control and to keep his own job safe. And now it's clear that the only way of doing that is to sentence Jesus to death. So he does it. It says he delivers Jesus over to their will. Well, I spent a long time this morning trying to unpack for you what's going on behind the scenes. The manoeuvrings, the ploys that different people were using. Sordid, isn't it? Unspeakably sordid. The sheer pragmatism that drives all the main characters who are there on the scene. The dishonesty. The lack of any principles at all. The priests and the rulers, they go to Pilate to present their case against Jesus. And what do they say to Pilate? "Oh, we are so concerned by what this man Jesus is doing, that he's a revolutionary against Rome, and we care so much about Rome, about the emperor." We've already said they know it's not true. But worse than that, even if it had been true, it would still have been sheer hypocrisy, because within hours they're agitating for the release of a man who is really a revolutionary against Rome, Barabbas. So on the one hand they're going to Pilate saying, "Oh, can't have a man like Jesus around. He's a traitor to Rome. That's all we're interested in." And 5 minutes later, they're saying, "Get Barabbas out of prison. The man who really is a traitor to Rome." That's the thing that makes you feel sick. The whole process is sick. The Jewish leaders pretend to be concerned about loyalty to Caesar. And then they get a rebel against Caesar released. Pilate goes through this travesty of a trial to establish whether Jesus is guilty of a crime against Caesar. And then once he's established that he's not, he sentences him to death and frees the man who is. They're all playing political games. While meanwhile, God's Son, the Holy One, the man who has shown nothing but wisdom and love and truth, he stands there. And as far as they're concerned, he's just a pawn in their little games. But that's the point. He does just stand there. You know, if this had been a novel, a work of fiction, if Luke had been a novelist, I'm sure that Luke would have shown Jesus as the most active player in this drama. He'd have had Jesus playing the lead role, saying lots of striking things, rebuking the wicked governor, denouncing the priests and the leaders, defending himself to the crowd. But that isn't what we've got here, is it? From the time that Jesus is brought before Pilate, Luke only records him saying one thing. Verse 3, he says to Pilate, "You have said so." But from there on, Luke doesn't record one word from Jesus. He's silent. While the priests hurl their lying accusations, when they're demanding that Jesus be executed, Jesus is silent. While Herod is demanding miracles and pouring out mockery, Jesus is silent. While Pilate negotiates with the crowds, and the crowds scream back their demand for Jesus to be crucified, Jesus is silent. Everyone else is frantic. Everyone else is scheming and talking and pleading and shouting and manoeuvring and plotting. But Jesus just stands there. Doesn't have to accuse, doesn't have to plead, doesn't have to negotiate. He can let it all go on around him, and it doesn't panic him into action. He doesn't feel he's got to say anything. He doesn't feel he has to get involved. He doesn't feel he's got to do anything except stand and wait for God's plan to be fulfilled. He can let the waves simply swirl around him. He's unmoved. He's utterly in control of himself. And though they don't know it, he's the one who is totally in control of the situation. He just stands there, the unchanging Son of God. Men can say what they want. They can do whatever is in their power to do. They can try to bring about their own schemes and their own plans, but he is simply himself, the Son of God, carrying out the one unchangeable plan which his Father drew up before the world was made. Nothing surprises him. Nothing panics him. He's simply there like a great rock. And the storm crashes around him, and the waves batter on him from all sides. But he's just the same. We read and sang at the beginning of the service Psalm 2, didn't we? We've sung that psalm a number of times over recent weeks. And isn't it graphic? Shows us the rulers and the kings in all their frantic scheming, in all their manoeuvring. Why do the nations conspire? Why do the rulers plot together? And that's what we're seeing here in Luke 23. This is fulfillment of Psalm 2. the so-called powers of this world, the Jewish rulers, the Gentile governor, the Idumean king Herod, and they're all together and they're all working out their little political games against the Lord, against his anointed one, against the true king whom God has chosen, against Messiah, against Christ. And he who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. And this is what he says. I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. The Lord Jesus, the anointed one, appointed by God to rule as the king, his representative forever. So men may do what they want. They can scheme and they can plan and they can lie and they can twist the processes of justice. But he's still there where his father has put him. They can do their worst. And they can imagine that they're winning. But he's there. His throne isn't threatened. God's plans for his king, for the Messiah, aren't at risk of failing. And the king knows it. Listen to King Jesus speaking. I will tell of the decree, he says. The Lord said to me, you are my son. This day I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage, and the ends of the earth your possession. Jesus knows the decree that his Father has spoken. He knows what his Father has planned. He knows that he will reign. He will conquer. He's only to ask the Father, and the Father will give him a kingdom that will stretch to the ends of the earth. And men can do what they want. They can tell whatever lies they choose. They can use all their political skills and carry out all their underhand plans. They can condemn him. They can execute him. But it will make no difference. The Father's decree will be fulfilled. And Jesus will break the nations with a rod of iron. And he will dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel. And he will triumph. Jesus just simply will not bring himself down to the level of these people. The priests, the rulers, Pilate, Herod, they can play their desperate games. Well, he won't get involved. Because he knows. He knows that his Father is sovereign. He knows that the plan is unchangeable. He knows that the victory is sure. Oh, he knows that the plan involves great suffering for himself. He's going to be crucified. He's going to hang naked, tormented and tortured. He's going to cry out in the darkness, lonely and abandoned. He's going to sob. But on the other side, his victory is certain, and he knows it. What a wonderful picture we have here of Jesus. In this sordid chapter, everyone else is so frantic. Pilate feeling the pressure, running this way, running that way, desperately trying to find ways out. The priests rushing round, trying to counter every move that Pilate makes. And meanwhile, Jesus at the centre, the one whose life is at stake. And he's so calm. Answering questions, at least some questions, if they're put to him. Staying silent as people pour their abuse at him and threaten him and lie about him. That strength. The strength that comes from utter certainty. And this is the strength that Jesus' people, those who believe in him, those who trust him, this is the strength they should have. This is the strength they can have. This is the strength they must have here in this world. You look at the people of the world and they're running round frantically. They're pursuing their dreams, their ambitions, their careers. They're worrying about anything and everything. And you can see them scheming and lying and planning and conniving and recruiting supporters to their little causes. And that isn't for us, because we believe in a sovereign God who is working everything together for good for those who love him, who are called according to his purpose. So we don't need to run around the way the people of the world run around. We don't need to use the methods they use. We don't need to panic when they do things that hurt us and that they imagine could harm us. We can remain calm, doing our duty, waiting for God to work out his great plans. That's the Christian's strength in every aspect of life. But especially it's our strength when it seems that Christ and his kingdom are under attack. When you see wicked rulers, whether they're people in government or just the influential trendsetters of our society, when you see them scheming and deceiving and twisting things in order to silence Christians and to undermine churches and to break the grip that Christ has on the world, we don't need to panic. The one who's throned in heaven laughs, and we can afford to laugh with him, because he has set his king on Zion, his holy hill. And Jesus will reign to the ends of the earth. We don't need to descend to the methods of the schemers. We don't need to abandon our principles. We don't need to use the arts of spin and the tools of propaganda. The kingdom of Christ isn't dependent on political maneuvering, or winning popular support, or getting the media on our side. Our job is just to stay calm and to carry on telling the truth and to carry on praying and to be willing to suffer if that's God's will, and to wait. To wait for God's purposes to be fulfilled. Let's just think for a moment about the crowds who shouted, "Crucify, crucify." We tried to look at all the main players in the story. We've tried to understand what drives them. So in the last 2 minutes, let's think again about the players and about the crowd. We looked firstly at the priests and the rulers. Why did they reject Jesus? They rejected him just because they hated him. And we've talked about why they hated him. We looked secondly at Pilate. Why did Pilate reject Jesus? Pilate rejected Jesus because his career was at stake, and he didn't want to lose his career. We looked thirdly at Herod. Why did Herod reject Jesus? Herod rejected Jesus because all Herod was interested in was pleasure, fun, and Jesus wasn't fun. He wasn't entertaining. But finally, fourthly, what about this crowd? Why did the crowd reject Jesus? And we've seen the answer. They rejected Jesus because he didn't go along with their agenda. They had decided they wanted a Messiah who would give them freedom from the Romans. a Messiah who would start a revolution, who would bring back the good times for Israel. And once they realized that Jesus wasn't going to do those things for them, they turned against him and they chose Barabbas instead. They had a list of things they wanted Jesus to be and to do, but they weren't interested in what he was offering them, what he had come to do. You know, some of you have been coming along here for a while, and you've been listening. And perhaps you've got your list of things that you hope Jesus will do for you. Maybe you're thinking, if I go along to church, my health will improve. Maybe you're thinking, if I turn to Jesus, maybe he'll sort out my marriage. Maybe you're thinking, if I become a Christian, maybe I'll stop feeling so depressed. So you've got your agenda. But is it Jesus' agenda? Jesus came to save sinners. Christ came into the world to save sinners. That's Jesus' agenda. You're someone who's done wicked things. You're someone with a wicked heart. You're someone who's treated God very wickedly. And Jesus' agenda is to save you. To wipe out your bad record. To change your bad heart. To bring you back to God. Forget your agenda. His is more important. Ask him to save you. Ask him to save you from your sins. And if that's what you really want, he really will.